Hello, and welcome to another episode of Exiting the Cave Short Reads. This week we arrive at the penultimate chapter of Book 3. Let's listen in as Lady Philosophy delivers one final pitch for unity and the good. I'll have a lot to say after this week's reading, so I hope you're sitting down.
"I quite agree," said I. "Truly all thy reasonings hold admirably together." Then said she, "What value wouldst thou put upon the boon shouldst thou come to the knowledge of the absolute good?"
"Oh, an infinite," said I, "if only I were so blessed as to learn to know God also, who is the good."
"Yet this will I make clear to thee on the truest grounds of reason, if only our recent conclusions stand fast."
"They will."
"Have we not shown that those things which most men desire are not true and perfect good precisely for this cause, that they differ severally one from another, and seeing that one is wanting to another, they cannot bestow full and absolute good, but that they become the true good when they are gathered, as it were, into one form and agency, so that that which is independence is likewise power, reverence, renown, and pleasant delight, and unless they are all one and the same, they have no claim to be counted among things desirable?"
"Yes, this was clearly proved, and cannot in any wise be doubted."
"Now, when things are far from being good while they are different, but become good as soon as they are one, is it not true that these become good by acquiring unity?"
"It seems so," said I.
"But dost not thou allow that all which is good by participation in goodness?"
"It is."
"Then thou must on similar grounds admit that unity and goodness are the same. For when the effects of things in their natural working differ not, their essence is one and the same."
"There is no denying it."
"Now dost thou know," said she, "that all which abides and subsides so long as it continues one, but so soon as it ceases to be one, it perishes and falls to pieces?"
"In what way?"
"Why, take animals, for example. When soul and body come together and continue in one, that is, we say, a living creature, but when this unity is broken by the separation of these two, the creature dies, and is clearly no longer living. The body also, while it remains in one form by the joining together of its members, presents a human appearance. But if the separation and dispersal of the parts breaks up the body's unity, it ceases to be what it was. And if we extend our survey to all other things, without doubt it will manifestly appear that each several thing subsists while it is one, but when it ceases to be one, perishes."
"Yes, when I consider further, I see it to be even as thou sayest."
"Well, is there aught," said she, "which in so far as it acts conformably to nature, abandons the wish for life and desires to come to death and corruption?"
"Looking to living creatures, which have some faults of choice, I find none that, without external compulsion, forego the will to live, and of their own accord hasten to destruction. For every creature diligently pursues the end of self-preservation, and shuns death and destruction. As to herbs and trees and inanimate things generally, I am altogether in doubt what to think."
"And yet there is no possibility of question about this either, since thou seest how herbs and trees grow in places suitable for them, where, as far as their nature admits, they cannot quickly wither and die. Some spring up in the plains, other in the mountains, some grow in marshes, others cling to rocks, and others, again, find a fertile soil in the barren sands. And if you try to transplant these elsewhere, they wither away. Nature gives to each the soil that suits it, and uses her diligence to prevent any of them from dying so long as it is possible for them to continue alive. Why do they all draw their nourishment from roots as from a mouth dipped into the earth, and distribute the strong bark over the pith? Why are all the softer parts like the pith deeply encased within, while the external parts have the strong texture of wood, and outside of all is the bark to resist the weather's inclemency, like a champion stout in endurance? Again, how great is nature's diligence to secure universal propagation by multiplying seed? Who does not know all these to be contrivances not only for the present maintenance of a species, but for its lasting continuance, generation after generation, forever? And do not also things believed inanimate on like grounds of reason seek each what is proper to itself? Why do the flames shoot lightly upward while the earth presses downward with its weight, if it is not that these motions and situations are suitable to their respective natures? Moreover, each several thing is preserved by that which is agreeable to its nature, even as it is destroyed by things inimical. Things solid like stones resist disintegration by the close adhesion of their parts. Things fluid like air and water yield easily to what divides them, but swiftly flow back and mingle with those parts from which they had been severed, while fire again refuses to be cut at all. And we are not now treating of the voluntary motions of an intelligent soul, but of the drift of nature. Even so it is that we digest our food without thinking about it, and draw breath unconsciously in sleep. Nay, even in living creatures the love of life cometh not of conscious will, but from the principles of nature. For oft-time in the stress of circumstances, will chooses the death which nature shrinks from, and contrarily, in spite of natural appetite, will restrains that work of reproduction by which alone the persistence of perishable creatures is maintained. So entirely does this love of self come from drift of nature, not from animal impulse. Providence has furnished things with the most cogent reason for continuance. They must desire life so long as it is naturally possible for them to continue living. Wherefore, in no way mayst thou doubt but that things naturally aim at continuance of existence and shun destruction.
I confess, said I, that what I lately thought uncertain, I now perceive to be indubitably clear.
Now that which seeks to subsist and continue desires to be one. For if its oneness be gone, its very existence cannot continue.
True, said I.
All things, then, desire to be one.
I agree.
But we have proved that one is the very same thing as good.
We have.
All things, then, seek the good. Indeed, you may express the fact by defining good as that which all desire.
Nothing could be more truly thought out. Either there is no single end to which all things are relative, or else the end to which all things universally hasten must be the highest good of all. Then she.
Exceedingly do I rejoice, dear pupil. Thine eye is now fixed on the very central mark of truth. Moreover, herein is revealed that which thou didst erstwhile profess thyself ignorant.
What is that? Said I.
The end and aim of the whole universe. Surely it is that which is desired of all. And, since we have concluded the good to be such, we ought to acknowledge the end and aim of the whole universe to be the good. Who truth pursues, who from false ways his heedful steps would keep, by inward light must search within in meditation deep. All outward bent he must repress, his soul's true treasure to possess. Then all that error's mists obscured shall shine more clear than light. This fleshly frame's oblivious weight hath quenched not reason quite. The germ of truth still lie within, whence we by learning all may win. Else how could ye the answer do, untaught to questions give? Were't not that deep within the soul, truth's secret sparks do live? If Plato's teaching erreth not, we learn but that we have forgot. Superficially, this chapter appears to be our long sought after denouement in the search for the absolute good and complete unity. But a careful listener will be deeply troubled by what Lady Philosophy is saying this week. Rather than reaching the cave exit to behold the light of pure truth, instead we are confronted with an attempt to address the problem of reconciling the apparently contradictory will to live with the will to unity with the good. To make the problem explicit, it comes down to this. If living things by nature yearn to live, but the yearning for unity requires abandonment of the body in order to give the soul free rein to seek reunion with God, whom we learned earlier was identical with the good, and yet the death of living things is the result of an imposition of disunity, then we seem to have a contradiction here. The reason for this contradiction, I think, is because Boethius was struggling to reconcile competing conceptions of the good, as expressed in the philosophical divergence between Aristotle and Plato. If you'll recall from previous episodes, we learned that Aristotle argued for a conception of the good that amounted to a kind of completion or actualization of natural potentials inherent to a given organism. This is achieved by way of repeated activity and under the guidance of an influence that directs an organism toward that actualization. For Aristotle, the good is not an abstraction, then, but a measurable reality, instantiated in every individual being. Because man has the potential for reason inherent to him, then his own excellence or completion is going to include the actualization of his contemplative potential. Here is how Aristotle puts it in the Nicomachean Ethics.
Let us return to the good we are seeking, and ask what it can be. It seems different in different actions and arts. It is different in medicine, in strategy, and in other arts likewise. What then is the good of each? Surely that for whose sake everything else is done. In medicine, this is health. In strategy, victory. In architecture, a house. In any other sphere, something else. And in every action and pursuit, the end. For it is for the sake of this that all men do whatever else they do. Therefore, if there is an end for all that we do, this will be the good achievable by action. And if there are more than one, these will be the goods achievable by action. But we must try to state this even more clearly. Since there are evidently more than one end, and we choose some of these, for example, wealth, flutes, and in general instruments, for the sake of something else, clearly not all ends are final ends. But the chief good is evidently something final. Therefore, if there is only one final end, this will be what we are seeking. And if there are more than one, the most final of these will be what we are seeking. Now we call that which is in itself worthy of pursuit more final than that which is worthy of pursuit for the sake of something else, and that which is never desirable for the sake of something else more final than the things that are desirable both in themselves and for the sake of other things. And therefore we call final without qualification that which is always desirable in itself and never for the sake of something else.
But there is a strangeness to Aristotle's notion of the good as a sort of complete actualization. Namely, no man is fully actualized until he has no potential left. Where potential is present, some further actualization is possible, and imperfection is still present, because anything that is incomplete is imperfect. So, having no potential left means that there is no further activity which could increase or improve the individual. and to have no further activity left to perform is to have ceased to change. But for living things, ceasing to change is tantamount to death, since living requires being in a constant state of change. Boethius recognized this problem and stated it explicitly in his own voice in this chapter. "Looking to living creatures, I find none that, without external compulsion, forego the will to live, and of their own accord hasten to destruction. For every creature diligently pursues the end of self-preservation, and shuns death and destruction." And he reiterates the issue from the ontological perspective in the words of Lady Philosophy. "Nature gives to each the soil that suits it, and uses her diligence to prevent any of them from dying, so long as it is possible for them to continue alive." This is Aristotelian telos. All things seek their end. An end of something is not a finish line or a stopping point, but a purpose or predetermined goal toward which a thing aims. It is the fullest actualization of whatever that thing is. Lady Philosophy admits as much at the end of the dialogue. "The end and aim of the whole universe is to seek the good." But here, Lady Philosophy means an absolute and universal good, in the sense of a Platonic form of the good, against which all other things are measured. As we saw in earlier chapters, this is not at all what Aristotle had in mind when he spoke of the good, and it's interesting to note that he argued explicitly against an absolute form of the good in the Ethics. "The men who introduced this doctrine did not posit ideas of classes within which they recognized priority and posteriority, which is the reason why they did not maintain the existence of a form embracing all numbers. But the term good is used both in the category of substance and in that of quality and in that of relation. And that which is per se, for example, substance, is prior in nature to the relative, for the latter is like an offshoot and an accident of being, so that there could not be a common idea set over all these goods. Further, since good has as many senses as being, for it is predicated both in the category of substance, as of God and of reason, and in quality, for example, of the virtues, and in quantity, for example, of that which is moderate, and in relation, for example, of that which is useful, and in time, for example, of the right opportunity, and in place, for example, of the right locality and the like. Clearly, it cannot be something universally present in all cases and single, for then it could not have been predicated in all the categories, but in one only. Further, since of the things answering to one form there is one science, there would have been one science of all the goods. But as it is, there are many sciences, even of the things that fall under one category. For example, of opportunity, for opportunity in war is studied by strategics, and in disease by medicine, and the moderate in food is studied by medicine, and in exercise by the science of gymnastics. And one might ask the question, what in the world do they mean by a thing itself, if, as is the case in man himself, and in a particular man, the account of man is one and the same? For insofar as they are men, they will in no respect differ. And if this is so, neither will good itself, and particular goods, insofar as they are good. But again, it will not be good any the more for being eternal, since that which lasts long is no whiter in color than that which perishes in a day. I think the answer to this riddle, or at least what Boethius thought the answer was, can be found in the Socratic dialogue that Boethius is surreptitiously referencing all throughout this chapter. Socrates argues at length in the Phaedo both for a form of the good and for how we know it's real, through the Platonic theory of recollection. Socrates' argument defending the absolute ideals is both interesting and poignant in the context of the consolation. In essence, it is a defense of skepticism from adversarial dualism. The union of body and soul is not, as Aristotle insists, a compound unity. Rather, the soul is encumbered by the body, and the only path to truth and unity is to shuck off the mortal coil, whose disposal is necessary for the attainment of the absolute good.
And now, O my judges, I desire to prove to you that the real philosopher has reason to be of good cheer when he is about to die, and that after death he may hope to obtain the greatest good in the other world. What again shall we say of the actual acquirement of knowledge? Is the body, if invited to share in the inquiry, a hinderer or a helper? I mean to say, have sight and hearing any truth in them? Are they not, as the poets are always telling us, inaccurate witnesses? And yet, if even they are inaccurate and indistinct, what is to be said of the other senses? For you will allow that they are the best of them. Well, certainly. Then, when does the soul attain truth? For in attempting to consider anything in company with the body, she is obviously deceived. True. Then must not true existence be revealed to her in thought, if at all? Yes. And thought is best when the mind is gathered into herself, and none of these things trouble her, neither sounds, nor sights, nor pain, nor any pleasure, when she takes leave of the body, and has as little as possible to do with it. When she has no bodily sense or desire, but is aspiring after true being. Certainly. And in this the philosopher dishonors the body. His soul runs away from his body and desires to be alone and by herself? That is true. Well, but there is another thing, Simmias. Is there or is there not an absolute justice? Oh, assuredly there is. And an absolute beauty, and absolute good? Of course. But did you ever behold any of them with your eyes? Certainly not. Or did you ever reach them with any other bodily sense? And I speak not of these alone, but of absolute greatness, and health, and strength, and of the essence or true nature of everything. Has the reality of them ever been perceived by you through the bodily organs? Or rather, is not the nearest approach to the knowledge of their several natures made by him who so orders his intellectual vision as to have the most exact conception of the essence of each thing which he considers? Certainly. And he attains to the purest knowledge of them who goes to each with the mind alone, not introducing or intruding in the act of thought, sight, or any other sense together with reason, but with the very light of the mind in her own clearness searches into the very truth of each. He who has got rid, as far as he can, of eyes and ears, and, so to speak, of the whole body, these being, in his opinion, distracting elements, which, when they infect the soul, hinder her from acquiring truth and knowledge. Who, if not he, is likely to attain the knowledge of true being? What you say has a wonderful truth in it, Socrates, replied Simmias. And when real philosophers consider all these things, will they not be led to make a reflection which they will express in words something like the following? Have we not found, they will say, a path of thought which seems to bring us and our argument to the conclusion that while we are in the body, and while the soul is infected with the evils of the body, our desire will not be satisfied. And our desire is of the truth, for the body is a source of endless trouble to us by reason of the mere requirement of food, and is liable also to diseases which overtake and impede us in the search after true being. It fills us full of loves and lusts and fears and fancies of all kinds, and endless foolery, and in fact, as men say, takes away from us the power of thinking at all. Whence come wars and fightings and factions? whence but from the body and the lusts of the body. Wars are occasioned by the love of money, and money has to be acquired for the sake and in service of the body. And by reason of all these impediments, we have no time to give to philosophy. And last, and worst of all, even if we are at leisure and betake ourselves to some speculation, the body is always breaking in upon us, causing turmoil and confusion in our inquiries, and so amazing us that we are prevented from seeing the truth. It has been proved to us by experience that if we would have pure knowledge of anything, we must be quit of the body. The soul in herself must behold things in themselves, and then we shall attain the wisdom which we desire, and of which we say that we are lovers, not while we live, but after death. For if, while in company with the body, the soul cannot have pure knowledge, one of two things follows. Either knowledge is not to be attained at all, or, if at all, after death. For then, and not till then, the soul will be parted from the body, and exist in herself alone. Oh, my blessed Simmias, is there not one true coin for which all things ought to be exchanged? And that is wisdom. And only in exchange for this, and in company with this, is anything truly bought or sold, whether courage, or temperance, or justice. And is not all true virtue the companion of wisdom, no matter what fears, or pleasures, or other similar goods or evils may or may not attend her? But the virtue which is made up of these goods, when they are severed from wisdom and exchanged with one another, is a shadow of virtue only, nor is there any freedom or health or truth in her. But in the true exchange there is a purging away of all these things, and temperance and justice and courage and wisdom herself are the purgation of them. The founders of the mysteries would appear to have had a real meaning, and were not talking nonsense when they intimated in a figure long ago that he who passes unsanctified and uninitiated into the world below will lie in a slough, but that he who arrives there after initiation and purification will dwell with the gods.
I think you can see why I characterized it as poignant now. This is not merely Boethius leaning on Socrates for a reason to believe in the absolutes. This is his last-ditch attempt to give his own life and death a transcendent meaning. By invoking the Phaedo, Boethius is hoping to give his last moments on earth the same significance as Socrates' last moments on earth. One could argue that Boethius is making a subtle appeal to a typological characterization of his own life. In other words, in some sense, the lives of all proper philosophers are the reinstantiation of the life of Socrates himself. Such an allusion could itself be a metaphor for the sacrifice of Christ as well. In the end, I don't think Boethius fully resolved the conflict between the two senses of the good. The gap between Aristotle's immanent or emergent good for particulars and Plato's transcendent absolute and universal good is a problem that will always haunt us. As an aside, one tantalizing possibility to consider is that both are unified in the Thomistic conception of God as the universal and all-pervasive act of to be in itself. But this speculation is a subject for a whole podcast series all by itself, so I have to leave it here. Lady Philosophy leaves us with a soaring verse on the attainment of truth, once again making reference to the theory of recollection found in the Phaedo. It's interesting to note the subtle callback to the allegory of the cave here as well, in the description of the soul unencumbered of all that error's mists obscured, so that it can finally see the truth shine more clearly than light. Next week, Boethius will reaffirm his commitment to the good as an absolute, and then Lady Philosophy introduces us to the subject we will be addressing at length in Book 4, God's Omnipotence and the Problem of Evil. Plus, for those of us who enjoyed the episode on Lady Philosophy's identity,
we'll be revisiting the Book of Wisdom, Chapter 8. So stay tuned for that. Bye-bye.